This is a repeat of a great show we aired last summer. Enjoy!
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. I predict that soon the phrase reading the newspaper will be as quaintly outdated as dialing the phone. I predict that paper newspapers will be a luxury reserved for those willing to pay a lot for the Sunday ritual of swapping sections with loved ones. I predict that newspapers will cease to be one-stop info shops and begin to focus on reporting in specific areas while also serving as reliable aggregators, collators, and filters for the rest of the news. I predict that many of America's great newspapers will survive. I predict these things at very little cost to me, because nobody will remember anyway. For instance, Douglas McIntyre, editor of 24/7 Wall Street, predicted that 8 of the country's top 50 daily papers would cease publication within 18 months. That was about 19 months ago, and all of them are still publishing.
No, I think what we did is we picked our fault the wrong newspapers. We looked at the large markets, and what happened is that Denver went out of business, and Seattle went out of business, and Arizona went out of business. So I think from the standpoint of sentiment, we were right. From the standpoint of picking the markets, we were wrong.
I think newspapers will be around in one form or another for a long, long time.
Margaret Sullivan is the editor of the Buffalo News in New York. If McIntyre's glass is half empty, hers is half full.
I think there was a period of catastrophizing about a year ago. The combination of the recession and a very quick decline in newspaper revenue combined to make it seem as though newspapers were about to close their doors, but they really haven't.
But many smaller papers have passed away. The Tucson Citizen, the Rocky Mountain News, the Baltimore Examiner, Kentucky Post, Cincinnati Post, King County Journal, Union City Register Tribune.
In almost every case, those papers had competition in their cities or their regions. And that's something that's been changing for a long time and is nothing new. Where you'd be particularly concerned is if a substantial size city or region had no daily newspaper. And that is not happening.
Maybe Ann Arbor, Michigan doesn't count as substantial. Or maybe it doesn't count because its daily paper still exists online. It all depends on what you count. Douglas McIntyre of 24/7 Wall Street counts everything. The decline in print advertising, most newspapers' largest source of funding, and printing costs, which account for half of many newspapers' expenses.
If you look at the 25 largest newspapers by circulation, a number of those newspapers cut their circulations by 10 to 20% in the last year. To me, there's not much of a distinction between having to cut your distribution base that rapidly and going completely out of business.
There's no question that print advertising revenue is down substantially.
Margaret Sullivan.
It has stabilized quite a bit, which is good. I mean, I think the reason that a year ago or 18 months ago we were seeing these dire predictions is that it seemed as though that was in free fall. I think that free fall has stopped, and part of the reason for that is that the recession has eased, and part of it is that we've cut expenses drastically, and so we're getting our bottom line in better balance.
In fact, the profit margin for the New York Times may improve this year.
Well, that's going from a loss, though, which in the business of publicly held companies doesn't count much.
Douglas McIntyre.
Except for Rupert Murdoch, the newspaper industry has no access to capital. The largest newspaper companies in the United States, with the exception of the Washington Post Company, borrowed lots and lots of money, and they mostly borrowed it to buy other newspapers. The newspaper industry thought that the newspaper industry was a good business. So you have huge companies like McClatchy, which own the Detroit paper, they own the Miami paper. I mean, they own a number of the largest papers in the United States, and they have $2 billion in debt.
Glass half empty.
Readership is great.
Glass half full.
We've never had better readership than we have now because we have all the people who read us online and all the people who continue to read us in print.
And finally, I predict that the argument over the future of the newspaper will grow less shrill as the surviving institutions get on with the business of surviving. With possible help from the government, cooperative ventures, Google, yes, Google, and even users. It's all part of this week's review of
Present and Future Business Models for Monetizing the Newspaper Industry.
Up first, help from the government. Since December of last year, the Federal Trade Commission has hosted a series of workshops assembling members of the press, academics, and bloggers to discuss ways to shore up newspapers in the digital age. On May 24th, it released a discussion paper in response to the workshops, seeking to highlight proposals that would, quote, appear most useful, feasible, platform neutral, resistant to bias, and unlikely to cause unintended consequences. These proposals include government subsidies and tax exemptions for newspapers, taxes on new news platforms such as tablet computers and internet service providers, and revisions of intellectual property law. According to BuzzMachine.com blogger Jeff Jarvis, though, the FTC's discussion draft heavily favors proposals that would not only unfairly prop up the ailing newspaper model, but would stymie innovation.
In 35 pages of text, blogs are mentioned once in a parenthesis and otherwise are a footnote. There's something wrong with that vision of the future. We're very early in the days of this new digital age now, and there's a lot of work going on in new business models for news. And so to act as if the business model of news is already broken, I think, is the first mistake the FTC made. The next mistake was to assume that news is only newspapers. The next mistake was to leave out the disruptors and entrepreneurs who I think are going to reinvent journalism. The next mistake was then to do some very dangerous things, to consider extending copyright and limiting fair use is all about free speech. There's a case going on right now called the Fly on the Wall case that involves hot news.
The Fly on the Wall, that's the web aggregator that was sued by an investment bank for publishing a news item. The bankers claimed, based on like a 100-year-old Supreme Court decision, was their property.
And now big news organizations hope to bring this to fight against aggregators. And the FTC salutes this. And they even mentioned, Bob, the phrase proprietary facts. That's frightening in a constitutional First Amendment copyright view of things. Facts cannot be owned. In the Fly on the Wall case, there are competing friend of the court briefs, one from Google and Twitter, the other side from 14 big news organizations. The big news organizations are trying to act as if the mere act of spending money on news gives them a right to own it for some period of time. But as Google points out in its brief, in this new world of us all creating news and us all having instant access to the news, the notion that anyone can own news, own a fact, own knowledge for a period of time is not only unconstitutional, it's futile.
Yeah, but just to play the devil's advocate for a moment, it's not just facts, it's news, which involves uncovering facts, analyzing them, you know, often at great expense by news organizations in competition with one another, who go to a great deal of trouble to report only to find out that aggregators and others are immediately putting this stuff up on their own websites, you know, at zero cost to themselves.
Aggregators aren't stealing content. They are sending audience to the news organizations. It's up to the news organization to then understand how to find a valued relationship with those readers. I'm not sure the FTC should be doing anything. I would argue that we're in a phase of news being more competitive than it has been in 50 years. The FTC is charged with nurturing competition, so let it go. Now, at the same time, we have the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, holding really pretty much similar hearings on similar questions. The FCC could do something good for news by getting broadband everywhere, but I'm also scared about it thinking that it should meddle in content.
Okay, but I keep reading about various startups and digital experiments that are not panning out. One just shuttered itself in the last couple of weeks. I think it was called News Labs. The New World Order seems they're dropping like flies. What are the emergent services and technologies specifically that are an alternative to, you know, the late Mr. Dumpty?
Startups are hard. Startups do fail, but that doesn't mean that we're doomed to fail in the future. We're going to have to try and experiment with a lot of things. So I see legacy media companies like Journal Register experimenting right now with putting out their newspapers entirely using free tools online. I see Politico starting Politico Local, which I think can operate in a network with bloggers around Washington at a very low cost and compete at a low cost with the Washington Post. In Germany this week, Welt Compact is handing over an entire issue to bloggers. I see a lot of innovation going on. The future is about innovation, not about trying to protect the past. So startups will die, newspapers will die, and in that, entrepreneurs will find new opportunities. And I believe we'll have a market demand for journalism the market will meet.
Now, I should say, as a matter of full disclosure, that I was one of the people who made a presentation at one of these hearings. It was not an optimistic one, but it was a presentation nonetheless. And I did it because I thought that these were people of goodwill and good faith. And I think the exercise was useful for evaluating where we are historically. Do you think that there is nothing in the draft version of the FTC's report that is useful in any way whatsoever?
I see little of journalistic or intellectual rigor in this report. I see nothing about the business of journalism, which is what we're really talking about here. I see very little fact gathering. I see a lot of opinions. It, you know, sounds a lot like blogs, doesn't it? At the FTC hearing, I said to them, please stay off our lawn. At the similar FCC hearing, I was proud to begin my testimony with the word bababooey, because I think we've seen what the FCC has done before when it got involved in content. Witness Howard Stern.
And the FCC, shame on you. Shame. Shame on you and your families. Where is the First Amendment? Anyway, I hope the bullies feel good about themselves and they've won. They've won, I've lost. And we've all lost. Believe me when I tell you we've all lost.
Yeah, the catchphrase you invoked wasn't an issue with the FCC, but a lot of other Stern content was ruled indecent, and his networks were fined millions.
I am not a libertarian. I'm a Democrat, but I sure sound like one right now because I want the government to stay the hell away from speech.
You kids get off in my lawn! Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Jeff Jarvis teaches at City University of New York Graduate School of Journalism and blogs, pretty famously, at buzzmachine.com.
Coming up, to paywall or not to paywall, and why Google wants to save newspapers.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Newspapers across this country are dying. Look at Seattle, look at Denver. It's like a plague. And unless we think of something to do to stop it from spreading, it's gonna wipe us out like a great big tidal wave. Oh no, oh a tidal wave. Oh no, an internet tidal wave. Oh no.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. One of the biggest questions concerning the future of the newspaper business is a pretty simple one. Should newspapers charge readers for access to stories online? In other words, should they put up paywalls? The pro-paywallers say original, reliable reporting is expensive, so why should papers give it away for free? On the other hand, do newspapers really want to cut people off from their content? The New York Times announced recently it will put up a paywall next year, but the paywall poster child is definitely media mogul Rupert Murdoch. His Times of London and Sunday Times instituted paywalls this year. And, of course, there's the Wall Street Journal. Alan Murray is the deputy managing editor and executive editor online for the Journal. Murray says from day one, the Journal has charged its readers for online content.
Way back in 1996, a decision was made that we thought our content was valuable and that if people wanted it, they were going to have to pay for it. But look, we put a lot of things outside of that paywall. Sports coverage, arts and entertainment coverage, selected stories that we think might have a wider audience. It's a pretty standard strategy for business, right? I mean, you allow people to come in, sample your wares, but then say, if you want it all, folks, you have to pay. But we publish, these days, we publish probably 70% of our content behind the paywall.
From the beginning, the stuff you've been able to protect and to get cash money for is what I would term market intelligence, business news that is actionable for business people. Do you ever give any of that away?
We do sometimes. If it's a big story or a popular story, we'll put it outside the wall. But at the end of the day, if what you want is access to the full depth of Wall Street Journal business and financial news, you're going to have to pay. You know, one of the things that we've found, and I think many people in media miss this, is that your most popular content and your most valuable content, in the sense that people are willing to pay you good money for it, are most of the time not the same thing. A lot of time, the most popular content It can be gossipy or politics that have more entertainment value, but it's also the kind of stuff that you can get other places. And the reason people come to the Wall Street Journal is because they know they'll find things that they won't find anywhere else, and that's what they'll pay for.
I think it's probably no coincidence that the three news organizations that have succeeded very well thus far with paywalls are the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times of London, and The Economist. What do these things have in common? They have all of that actionable business information that we were discussing earlier. Does the limited paywall structure that you have work for more general interest publications? Do you think the LA Times or the Chicago Tribune have the capacity to make people put cash on the barrelhead?
You will if you figure out what is it that you do that is uniquely valuable to your readers. I mean, what if the Houston Chronicle had decided 15 years ago, you know what, we got a pretty interesting position here right in the middle of oil land. What if we become the world's leading source of information on the oil industry? Is there money in that? Well, you bet. There are a lot of other players who decided to do that instead of the Houston Chronicle. And frankly, news organizations probably should have been doing that all along. But I think the nature of the local news monopoly made it unnecessary to ask those kinds of tough questions.
So your advice to all those general interest or horizontal media organizations is to discover your inner verticals and monetize them?
That's what I do. It's going to be extremely difficult to support a robust news gathering operation on advertising alone. So they're going to have to find other sources of revenue. And if that means discovering their inner verticals, then so be it.
One of the quirks of the journal's paywall is that you can sneak and get in kind of the back door through a Google search. You may not be able to go to WSJ.com and find the article that's been recommended to you, even by a link. But if you see something on Google search and click on it, lo and behold, there's the article and you haven't paid a dime.
I guess I'd say two things about that. One is, if you want to spend your entire day trying to recreate the Wall Street Journal through the back door using Google search, instead of paying us the $2 that it costs to get the newspaper, go do it. The second thing is, I think Rupert Murdoch has made it very clear that that arrangement may not last forever.
Because he is actually trying to negotiate with Google. And negotiate, I think, is the kind way of phrasing it.
I think I've said all I'm going to say on that subject. I don't speak for the big boss.
Just one final thing. What do you say to the purists who believe that any attempt to extract cash for content is quaint and unsustainable in a digital environment?
They're wrong. I mean, we're doing it right now. We get, you know, roughly half of our revenue from advertising and the other half from subscription. There's simply not enough money in digital advertising to hire what journalism requires.
Alan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Alan Murray is Deputy Managing Editor and Executive Editor online for The Wall Street Journal. Alan Rusbridger is the editor of The Guardian newspaper in London. Paywalls, he has said, will lead the industry into a, quote, sleepwalk into oblivion.
I think the future is going to be a world in which everyone, and by everyone I mean everything in science, academia, politics, is going to be open and linked and collaborative. So I think it's a very big statement for journalism to decide to withdraw from that world.
You've said that journalism is a public service, but of course public service isn't the same thing as charity. Who's going to pick up the tab for your noblesse oblige?
We're actually making quite a lot of money on the digital side of the business already. In the current year, we will make about £40 million. This is not a trivial sum that we're earning, and that comes from having an audience of something like 35 million around the world. The experience of others so far is if you put a paywall around general content, and the only people who have successfully done it so far have people who have specialist, generally financial content, is that you lose something like between 90 to 97% of your audience. That seems to me one of the reasons for not rushing behind a paywall, because actually one of the things we have is extremely large audiences who still believe in our brands. And that advantage is not going to last forever. And that's why I'm not in any hurry to decimate my audience.
I think that in the foreseeable future, perhaps neither a paywall nor the status quo solves the long-term problem of generating enough money to underwrite a robust news organization such as The Guardian's. Then what?
You may be right, and in which case there's going to have to be some kind of subsidy model. And if you look around the world at the moment, there is a kind of subsidy model for the kind of journalism that we do. So if it's the Washington Post, in lean years, they get subsidized by the Kaplan educational business. Rupert Murdoch subsidizes the Times and the Sunday Times from Sky and the profits of the Sun and the News of the World, his tabloids. The Guardian is subsidized by the Scott Trust. The Independent is now subsidized by a Russian oligarch. But I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that if we think instead about the way the rest of the web is going, I think there are effort-saving and therefore money-saving ideas there to do with collaborating and linking and using networks and not trying to do everything ourselves.
Will you be happy for The Guardian to be part author of original content and part aggregator?
Yeah, let me give you an example. A couple of years ago, we thought the environment is going to be the big story of our generation. We have four or five environment correspondents, including one in the US, one in China. And they're all very smart, and they've got PhDs, and they understand the subject very well. So we said to our environment correspondents, go to the places you respect most and choose the people you respect to partner with us.
Are these bloggers? Are these academic institutions, research foundations?
A mixture of all. We had the same conversation with a science correspondent. I said, you know, are there people blogging who we would trust to have on our site? And the science correspondent said, are you joking? There are fantastic science blogs who, you know, we would be privileged to host. We then did a revenue sharing deal with them. And what we're getting is much bigger audiences, much more diverse content, more advertising. And it suits our partners too, because they get this huge audience and traffic that they couldn't possibly get alone. I think it's thinking of ideas like that, which are only possible if you're open to the web, that I think we have to concentrate on rather than thinking, let's throw up gigantic walls around what we do, try and do it all ourselves, and force people to pay for it.
Alan, thank you very much.
It was good to talk.
Alan Rusbridger is the editor of The Guardian in London.
Often, the blame for the destruction of the newspaper business lands squarely on Google. Thanks to a Google search, we can find what we're looking for without flipping past print ads. So advertisers are far less willing to pay for them. But if, as The Atlantic's James Fallows wrote recently, everyone knows that Google is killing the news business, few people know how hard Google is trying to bring it back to life. Fallows has logged many hours at Google in the past year, interviewing engineers and strategists, all working on one thing, strengthening newspapers. Why? Two reasons.
A low road reason, which they admit but don't stress, and a high road reason. The low road reason is something Eric Schmidt, the CEO, and full disclosure, a longtime friend of mine, he said that Google could not afford to be seen as the vulture picking off the dead carcass of the news industry.
Why not?
Well, I guess, you know, that they've seen that, it's been a real business factor for Microsoft during its days of greatest hubris, and for Facebook now. If people don't like them, there are ways in which that can have some business ramifications. So they don't really want to be seen that way, especially with their famous motto of don't be evil.
Mm-hmm.
The high road reason that I thought was just kind of blather, but I became more persuaded of, is that they think that it is in their interest as providers and indexers of information online, if that information becomes polluted, bad, junky, people are going to have less reason to turn to them.
Getting down to brass tacks, you highlighted three specific areas that Google has been working on to help bolster the newspaper business, beginning with something called Living Stories.
Living Stories is a way that if you're an organization doing a lot of things which were all around a central important topic, it would combine them in a special site just for that topic where you mm-hmm. could have charts there and it would automatically bring in everything that was aligned to this. And also, it would ensure that this site got disproportionate brownie points.
In other words, pops up high in the placement.
Yes, the newspaper then gets more advertising revenue, gets more viewers, et cetera. So it's an attempt to reward news organizations with the main reward Google can offer, which is steering traffic there for doing what seems like higher-end news.
They're doing something else called Fast Flip.
The Fast Flip idea is a way to sort of set up the online caching of display of magazine pages so that you can flip through the stories as if you were flipping through a magazine and be able to sort of get engaged that way more attractively. The idea is that there are things about a paper magazine and a paper newspaper which are ergonomically better.
So you don't have to hit next page, next page.
You just push an arrow button and it's like you're flipping the pages.
One last idea that Google has, YouTube Direct.
If you have this code, it allows people very easily to feed in YouTube clips to you. You can easily review them and decide, I'm going to post this and I'm not going to post that. An example would be during a natural disaster, a volcano or a tornado or something, the local newspaper, they could have 20 videos their viewers had sent in. Here's what it looks like in this part of town. Here's the people who have to be rescued here. So the idea is to reduce the barrier to allowing people to have essentially their own video production stations.
It's still the print ads that carry most of the weight of financing these papers, and the print ads are going away. How is Google working to solve that problem?
Just to make up a number, if an advertiser would pay $1 per subscriber seeing an ad in My Magazine, The Atlantic, or the New York Times, or whatever, they might pay one penny per same viewer online. And the unusual argument from the people at Google is they think this is a trend that's going to reverse. For example, I was interviewing, again, Eric Schmidt, the CEO, who was saying that the iPad is probably the first of dozens of devices that will follow it over the next 5 or 10 years. And each of these should make it possible to eliminate what is now worst about online display advertising, which is that it's annoying. The idea from Google is that's a sign that those ads are not really attuned to who you are, what you're looking for. So if you had on your iPad something that knew where you were, and what kind of food you were looking for and where you wanted to go, it could bring you an ad that was interesting to you in that context.
Mm-hmm.
So personalization, as Schmidt put it, within the limits of creepiness, could make ads more valuable.
There's been a lot of debate this year, particularly about paywalls. In your piece, it seems like everyone at Google agrees that paywalls are inevitable.
Something I tried to convey during this article was the cultural difference between being in the middle of the normal journalism world, as I've been for all my life, and being in a tech company that's thinking about journalism, because something that many people in the media debate as if it were a really religious issue, will people ever pay online or will they not, just wasn't interesting to people at Google. And their answer was, of course they're going to pay. And the model here that they explicitly use is the shift from only free TV to the whole variety of TV subscriptions now that people get in a lot of different ways and pay on average a fair amount of money for each month. That historically you can't make people pay for the same thing they've been used to getting for free. But if you give them new things in new delivery vehicles, whether it's on the iPad or some other device, or new features tailored to them or new conveniences, that is the general direction in which the people at Google at least think that things are bound to evolve.
So what do you think in general of Google's prospects for keeping the industry from going under?
I think, number one, it's valuable for the news industry to know that probably the most markedly successful company in the world thinks that there is hope for our business, which otherwise seems just to be moribund. And second, the idea that experimentation is the core is also, I think, valuable. Krishna Bharat, who is the guy who invented Google News and who watches news stories from all around the world flow through his little screen, he says it's striking to him how you have a weird duplication of effort in the journalistic world, that when something big happens, 90% of the talent in the journalistic world will be writing about that one same story. He said that he thought over time there'll be a kind of redistribution of effort to other areas where there's not the same kind of piling on. And this, I think, illustrates a really interesting cultural split in our business. Every show you do is an experiment. Every article I do is an experiment, but the organizational structures we're in have been relatively static. And so if we think that the whole structures also need to experiment, then I think there's a way we can get through this and find different ways to find revenue for news of a different sort, but it'll be the same basic function.
News of a different sort is exactly the point here, though, isn't it? Because newspapers have always been one-stop shops. In the process of saving newspapers, you're going to have to fundamentally change them.
Yes, and many of the enterprises we think of as being old as the hills now, for example, Time Inc., that was invented during a time of real turmoil in the 20s and 30s. And the newspaper business has gone through real revolutions, both in its editorial approach and its business approach every 50 or 60 years. I think we've been through a time of deceptive stability in the news business over the last maybe half century. But I think new ways of delivering information, new ways of engaging the populace in providing new information, I think it has to produce a richer news environment in the long run, but a different one.
Jim, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for your questions.
Jim Fallows is a national correspondent for The Atlantic.
Well, I'm trying to read my Sunday Times. It costs a nickel and 12 dimes. I bought a late Saturday night. I've almost finished, but not quite. It weighed a ton. It seemed to me that each one of them must take a tree to make. And also, I should think it takes about a gallon of ink.
Coming up, can a focus on local news save papers?
Thanks for listening to this encore presentation of our newspaper show. This is On the Media.
All the heavy-duty news, it gives you the over-informed blues, and I'm so relieved when one's all through. Thumb through one, get on to two. I'm a showbiz kind of guy, the business is my life. Yeah, that's no lie. Two's one of my favorite parts, entertainment, leisure arts. Which movie's great, which Broadway play? Exclamation points away. The next time that things get this great, as sports way up in Section 8.
Support for On the Media comes from Constant Contact, offering tools to manage, monitor, and measure social media. Learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. The N.E.E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Paywalls, micropayments, iPad apps, there is no shortage of business models purported by at least somebody to be the savior of newspapers. And then there's the content itself. One school of thought says that if you really want to attract readers, go local. Very local. The New York Times began its own experiment with so-called hyper-local reporting. Marianne Giordano is deputy metro editor at the Times and oversees the project called The Local. Marianne, welcome to OTM.
Thank you, Bob.
First of all, to begin with a very simple question, how do you diagnose the problems with newspapers today? You've talked about the gannetization of America. Explain what you mean.
Part of the reason that newspapers are in so much trouble is that they were all scooped up into these media conglomerates that then took away the local flavor, took away the local voice, brought in young reporters who stayed for, you know, a year or two and then moved on. Nobody really was vested in these communities. But a lot of small, privately owned community newspapers stuck it out, and they're still doing okay. They may not be the greatest journalism products in the world, but they really have a focus. And I think that a lot of big newspapers are seeing this whole hyper-local thing as a way to reclaim some of the circulation and some of the readers that they lost. Whether it can make money or not, no one knows for sure.
You know, before we go any farther, talking about the particulars of your efforts,
mm-hmm.
Can we just define hyperlocal?
We defined hyperlocal as 50 to 60,000 people who have common interests, things like school system, parks, tax base. They want to read basically everything you print because it affects them. And what we wanted to do was not only provide local news, but provide it in a way that was a conversation with our readers. So we solicited content from the public. We worked with our readers to cover themselves.
So you went into Fort Greene, Brooklyn, which is mm-hmm. a kind of demographically diverse neighborhood, racially, economically, and so forth.
Yes.
And also into Millburn, South Orange in North Jersey, a much more well-heeled suburb. Each of the blogs was a one-man band.
Mm-hmm.
Is any of them generating enough advertising revenue to pay the salary of the one-man band member?
The New York Times decided early on that this was going to be a journalistic experiment. The advertising department stayed on the sidelines. We did not make any money, and you're absolutely right. These are expensive. They're also really high burnout jobs. It's a 24/7 enterprise to start a hyperlocal blog if you want to do it in a way that, you know, covers news and does more than just mouth off on local issues. Therefore, you probably have to have one or two staff, particularly if you are selling advertising. But some entrepreneurs out there are doing it. One of them is BaristaNet in Montclair, New Jersey. Two women who are journalists started this site up several years ago, and they are now expanding. In fact, they've taken over the area we were covering in New Jersey.
Well, let's talk about that, because you're pulling up stakes in the Milburn South Orange experiment and kind of ceding the territory to BaristaNet.com. Why?
Well, really, our experiment there ran out, especially since we, as I said, did not pursue it as a business. We did not sell advertising. So it was really an expenditure for the New York Times. We had such good readership and loyalty and such a large group of regular contributors. We looked for every way possible to keep that site going. You know, with the Brooklyn site in New York, we have a partnership with the City University of New York, CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. We're starting up a third site with NYU in the East Village later in the summer. We could not find that kind of relationship in New Jersey. And then BaristaNet offered to come into this area and we helped them get going. And I think that's part of our experiment too, in that we're really looking closely at creating networks of hyperlocal sites. We're not quite sure how it's going to work, whether it's going to feed into the newspaper or just nytimes.com, or, you know, how do we at the New York Times make sure that these sites are up to our standards and our journalistic values that we at least aspire to. The experiment will continue in that direction. Meanwhile, our associations with NYU and CUNY, they are continuing to look at business models. They are continuing to look at ways in which citizens can be trained in journalism, at least some of the basics. All of those things can be integrated into the way the New York Times covers virtually everything.
Burnout job, very little advertising revenue. Can anybody make a go at this?
Entrepreneurs are. I think a lot of newspapers are doing it. Ironically, Gannett, which bought up all these local newspapers, is now going back at hyperlocal blogging full time. They're hiring a bunch of people. You know, Bob, I really don't know the answer. No one knows. There are many, many wiser people than me out there who feel there's literally billions of dollars of local advertising that's now going to everything from the yellow pages to, you know, placemats in the diner that could be going to these hyperlocal sites. If the New York Times made an investment here of a year and a half so far in these sites, I would argue that we got our money's worth in what we've learned.
All right, Marianne. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Marianne Giordano is Deputy Metro Editor at the New York Times. She oversees the local, the paper's experiment with hyperlocal journalism.
And now we pause for a really old ad we found on YouTube.
As a kid, I wasn't sure whether I wanted to be a baseball player, an astronaut, or a rock star. But my parents said, whatever you do, get into the habit of reading. I'm John Bon Jovi. Encourage your kids to read everything, especially newspapers. Reading newspapers will bring the world to their door. And who knows? One day they could reach the top of the charts.
Yochai Benkler probably would dispute the idea that we require newspapers in order to become informed rock stars. He's the author of the magisterial Wealth of Networks, which describes how the one-way capital-intensive professional information economy, the one that supported the great American newspaper for more than a century and a half, is giving way to a many-to-many low-capital cooperative model. And he applauds the transition to a mixed system in which concerned citizens combine their time and expertise with professionals to unearth and disseminate important information. It's already happening, he notes. A patron-funded independent investigative newsroom called ProPublica won the Pulitzer Prize this year for its coverage of a New Orleans hospital making life and death decisions during Katrina. And there are many examples.
So let's take, for example, the story of the video of the helicopter shooting at civilians in 2007 in Iraq that was done WikiLeaks. You have the traditional model of Reuters looking for 2 years through a Freedom of Information Act to find the video of its reporters who were killed by the shots. Then you have one internal source leaking the information, since then arrested, putting it out on the website of a group that sits globally in various countries, most recently in Iceland, where they can be protected by the law, and making that material available, then commented on by the rest of the world. The source of funding is user contributions from around the world. So that's what I mean when I say that there's a new system developing. if you've got questions of political reporting. Suddenly you've got the reemergence of the party presses in the form of sites like Daily Kos, like Town Hall, and don't need the commercial motivation and certainly do it on an amateur basis.
Earlier in the nation's history, a lot of the reporting was done by activist presses. What you're saying is that because information comes from a source that may have a strong opinion, doesn't necessarily mean that the information can't be trusted, right?
Objectivity, as it's been practiced in journalism as a profession, ends up skewing the evidence. When you compare treatments of global warming in peer-reviewed scientific papers to treatment of global warming in newspapers, the sense that objectivity needs to be expressed by giving equal airtime, as it were, to both, completely skewed the presentation of the quality of the scientific evidence. Second, the public perception of the ideal of objectivity led to a level of trust in newspapers as opposed to a continuous act of critical reading.
So much source material is available online that readers themselves can do the job of getting second opinions, of fact-checking, of reading the original documents, backing up the assertions of reporters until a sense of trust builds anew.
We assume suddenly that a good report will give us access to the underlying material so we can see for ourselves as opposed to trust me. Mm-hmm. Instead of trust, you get access and conversation. You get a respectful engagement. I think that's very healthy for a democratic readership.
Clay Shirky, in a blog posting last year, he's an expert in social media, wrote, quote, "When someone demands to know how we're going to replace newspapers, they are really demanding to be told that we are not living through a revolution. They are demanding to be told that old systems won't break before new systems are in place. They are demanding to be told that new methods of spreading information will improve previous practice rather than upend it. They are demanding to be lied to."
I think what he captures there is the fear. We can't assure continuation of anything. And it's not clear that the newscape of the late 90s or early 2000s, just before the revolution we're in now, is in fact anything like the utopia that hasn't been there for decades, if it ever was there to begin with. What we need to do is essentially say, what do we care about? We care about there being some set of people who are professionals, who will investigate on a sustained manner that they can make a living without necessarily being millionaires. We need the ability to extract information from powerful entities against their will. So we need some form of leak extraction and preservation mechanism. How do we do that? Well, that actually we might not need professionals for. That might be best done by a distributed system of peer production and collaboration online by people volunteering because they care. We need a system for people who are politically engaged and mobilized to be able to observe their representatives. Well, to some extent, we might need commercial. To some extent, we can do that with volunteers. The questions are not existential. They're practical. Their implications are existential, but the questions are practical. Music wasn't created with the invention of copyright in the phonograph, and it won't disappear. The necessity of people looking at their government didn't emerge from the moment of the large-scale advertising-supported newspaper, and it won't disappear at its end. We just have to understand how the systems will fill in those voids that exist and see whether they're better or not.
You listed all the different ways that other entities and other individuals could fill in if the newspaper, as we currently know it, goes away. But how much of this are we seeing?
What's absolutely true is that one of the research questions that we don't have the answer to yet is one that actually allows us to quantify how much of this has happened here, how much of that has happened there. When you look at the Iranian reform movement, I think you have to accept that as the first Gulf War was to the 24-hour news channel, so the Iranian reform movement was to people with their mobile phones on the streets in places that are extremely difficult to reach, being the sole source of raw footage. This is very powerful. When you look at this year's Pulitzer Prize and the reporting on the New Orleans hospital, you say, a nonprofit based on foundation funding was able to deliver some of the most important and impressive reporting for this year. That's one measure.
Let me throw out one last question. What some studies have shown is that people who are inclined to be informed are better informed now because of the internet. But those people who aren't interested in information are less likely to encounter it because the public square, so to speak, has been deserted, and that this is worrisome.
What are we lamenting? Are we lamenting the decline of a shared culture that's relatively dominated by a small number of people who can decide what everyone needs to know? That's not obviously a state that we have to yearn for. On the other hand, the fact that we have facilities for people who do want to be engaged to become much better informed, if it is easy, and here we have major questions of skills and education and socioeconomic status influencing who can and can't access, and that is a major focus for policy to assure. But assuming that that needs to be solved, from the perspective of a democratic society, this new state seems to me to be not utopia, but more attractive.
All right. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Yochai Benkler is a professor at Harvard Law School and co-director of Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. So as we approach the end of this week's show, we want to conclude with one final issue.
Present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry.
Yes, our jingle. We've been playing it for about a year now, and we thought it was time to make a new one. OTM producer Mark Phillips, who composed and performed it, has brought in a few more options for you to consider and vote on via our Facebook page. More on that later. But first, on to the audition. Mark, hello.
Hey.
So, Mark, what have you brought us?
People said that the last one was morose and sad, so I wanted to go a little bit happier. So let's give this one a try.
I feel like going out and buying a tube of Gleam. That's a jingle, that there.
The next one, I wanted to go for short and sweet. Let's hear that one.
Present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry.
Yeah, it's more of a sting, right, than a jingle. It's so brief.
Yeah.
And it's got a kind of a hip-hop vibe to it, which makes it much more contemporary, considering we are both, you know, elderly Jews.
Also, if you think about how we drop these things randomly into the show, that one would go in and out and leave no residue behind.
The next one is disturbing. It's a truly weird one. I hope the listeners do not pick this one.
Yeah, that's very People's Temple right down at the end. I just, no.
I like it.
This next one, I like this one. This one's good. It's kind of country.
Present and future business models to monetize the newspaper industry.
Does it have a certain depression quality? Because that would be appropriate.
Yeah, it's got a Dust Bowl vibe.
I'm depressed.
This one could be my favorite.
Present, future business models monetize the newspaper industry.
The trouble is that it leaves a residue. Once you've heard it, it's very hard to go back to the interview.
I'm profoundly disturbed, and I can't even say why. It just sounds futuristic in a world beyond gender or something.
I know what it is, Bob. What you heard is the digital future that doesn't include you.
Right. That might be it.
Any more?
We have one more. I wanted to go a little more dramatic.
Yeah. This is an existential issue. I love
love that one.
It leaves a residue.
So, like I said, this is a repeat of a show we first aired last summer. After we asked you to choose your favorite jingle, a lot of you said you liked the old one best. But after we counted up the votes, the country music version came out on top. Funnily enough, in the last 6 months, we haven't played any jingle, old or new.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, with more help from Alex Goldman, Brett Jaspers, and Michael Chaplin, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson. Our engineer was Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.